My name is Michael Guyett, publisher of The Lead Lag Report. Joining me there is Altea Espinosi. Altea, introduce yourself to the audience and to me formally. Who are you? What's your background? What have you done throughout your career? And what are you doing currently?
Yeah, absolutely, Michael. So I'm head of fixed income strategy here at Saxo Bank. And my background is always been in fixed income for more than 12 years. I've been covering European sovereigns, U.S. sovereigns, and also corporate bonds in both continents. Currently, my focus is more on rates and central banks and monetary policies. So I hope to be helpful for you all today.
So 12 years, of course, overlaps with the Eurozone crisis of 2011, when what they termed the pigs were all the rage in terms of yields blowing out on the sovereign side. Clearly an exciting time to be a fixed income strategist then. I am curious if what's happened the last 3 years has been maybe more exciting from a career perspective, given what's happened to duration.
Absolutely. And what is exciting about the past 3 years is inflation. You see, the problem with the European sovereign crisis in 2011, 2012 was more about politics and underlying sovereign stress within the European countries. Being an Italian was very much heartfelt for myself as well. But what is interesting is that this kind of inflation in the past 3 years has never been seen since the 80s. And myself, and I'm sure many others, were not expecting such a high wave in inflation in the past couple of years to come.
What's the difference in the sovereign stress from that 2011 crisis with Europe to what the U.S. and really all governments have gone through the last 3 years? Because when I hear stress, my mind goes to volatility. And we've seen, you know, some of the greatest volatility really in history when it comes to long duration treasuries.
Absolutely. I think that the main difference is the way that investors are looking at bonds and how they price them. You see, in the sovereign period of time, investors were looking at the specific sovereigns within the European Union, and they were demanding a higher yield in order to hold these securities. Now, if we look at U.S. treasuries today, well, the term premium is below zero. So it means that effectively investors are not demanding a pickup over what nominal yields are representing. So meaning real rates, the break-even rates at this point in time. So, but I think, Michael, that might change. And the reason for that is that we have seen that already in the last quarter of 2023, when the term premium on 10-year U.S. treasuries rose again in positive core territory and hit 40 basis points. And that is just a sign that investors start to price the risk of holding these long-term securities in their portfolio.
Shouldn't that mean that corporate credit must at some point respond? I mean, the entire financial system is predicated on RF, right? The risk-free rate. And if the idea is that there's now pricing in of risk on the U.S. government debt side, I would think we would see credit spreads start to widen at some point.
Absolutely. Right now, corporate spread, but especially junk bond spreads are the tightest we have seen since before the COVID pandemic. If we look at how much junk bonds are paying over, for example, investment grade corporate bonds, they're paying only around 200 basis points. That has been a minimum within the past 10 years. But when we look at the Fed fund rate, we see that it remains the highest that we have seen since 2000 until today. So you are absolutely right, Michael. And that's why when I look at the bond market, I really dislike risk, credit risk at the moment. I dislike ultra long duration and I prefer quality. I prefer sovereigns, and maybe, you know, as central banks are preparing to cut rates, extend some duration within this space rather than picking risk among the credit bond space.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, I've been saying this to financial advisors that I talk to, but, you know, a lot of people will say it was obvious that we were going to enter a cycle where stocks and bonds would both sell off. And my response to that is, okay, you can argue it was obvious, but I don't think anybody had on their bingo cards you'd have the fastest rate hike cycle in history from the Federal Reserve. You'd have this duration crash and credit spreads, just, you know, junk versus AAA, to your point, would be at cycle lows at this point. Has that dynamic been surprising? I mean, that I've been early and wrong in arguing that, you know, inevitably a duration crash will result in a credit crash. But I still think there's a possibility for that if the lags are still in place.
Yes, for us, it has been surprising, actually. And the reason is that benchmark rates are the highest we have seen. But I think, Michael, what has been really supporting credit spreads at the moment has been this kind of delay in refinancing of coupon maturities coming up. You see, like last year and also this year, we have very little corporate bonds maturing. So corporate bond market is not testing the primary market really at this point in time. And I'm talking about junk bonds because we have seen a lot of investment grade supply in January and February this year. But junk bonds, especially like the cash straps one, they don't have a reason to go in the primary market and raise debt at this moment in time with basically absolute nominal yields to be the highest that they have seen since the global financial crisis until today.
And is it fair to say that there's an effect of low credit spread essentially is a reflationary or inflationary source, whereas rising spreads are more of a disinflation, deflationary force?
You can put it that way, but really, if we look at inflation or disinflation, at this point in time, the kind of pace of disinflation is going to weigh on credit, exactly like it will weigh on sovereign bonds. And the reason for that is that we have seen quite an uptick of disinflation in the past few months, but there are signs of stabilization in the high twos at this moment in time. Even tomorrow, CPI numbers, they are expected basically the headlines around 3.1 to remain the same as January, and the core CPI to adjust slightly lower.
The point about signs of stabilization is, I think, leads into a discussion around QT quantitative tightening. You sent a note saying tapering is coming sooner than most expect. It doesn't mean it's going to be good for duration, which maybe we can debate a little bit, but let's talk about the state of the Fed's balance sheet, quantitative tightening, in the context of the signs of stabilization.
Yeah, so what's happening here with quantitative tightening, and the reason why the Federal Reserve is starting to speak about that, is that it realizes that the quantitative tightening at this pace might start to put a strain on liquidity, and that's going to be a problem for the Federal Reserve. You see, if we look at coupon redemptions in the next 12 months, if the Federal Reserve doesn't adjust the cap on U.S. treasuries that are going to be run off from the balance sheet, well, we are going to have around 170 billion T-bills running off from the Federal Reserve balance sheet in just 1 year. And we had around 10 days ago, Waller saying that they want to increase T-bills, the size of T-bills in the Fed balance sheet, while decreasing the ones of coupon treasuries. So I think that the quantitative tightening at this point in time, tapering is going to be necessary because the Federal Reserve needs ample liquidity. They don't know exactly what ample liquidity means. There are some research from the St. Louis Fed that points it out to be around 10 to 12% of GDP, so between 3 to 3.3 trillion. But we are awfully close to that level if the Federal Reserve doesn't taper quantitative tightening.
So as I recall, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, when the Fed was expanding its balance sheet and buying long duration treasuries, yields would actually rise, right? Even though they were buying them up, the market saw that as expansionary. And then as they tried to do tapering or reducing, as I recall, yields fell. So it's very much a kind of counterintuitive type of movement. Is there a situation where the Fed could sell into the market, the market would absorb it and maybe result in sort of an opposite reaction on long duration yields than they might want or expect?
Well, right now, the Federal Reserve is not actively selling U.S. treasuries, but there has been an instance in the Federal Reserve history, which is around 2012, where the Federal Reserve started to sell actively T-bills to buy long-term U.S. treasuries. And that was to decrease the yield on that part of the yield curve. According to Waller's comment, well, they now want to do the opposite. So I don't exclude that they might want to sell actively long-term U.S. treasuries to buy short-term U.S. treasuries. And the reason for that is that realistically, the yield curve remains very much inverted, and the Federal Reserve needs a steeper yield curve in order to curb inflation successfully, because we can say that, well, they have been saying, actually, the Federal Reserve members have been saying that their monetary policy stance have been restrictive enough, but we have seen that GDP continues to grow at trend or below or above, apologize, and that is a sign that actually their monetary policy stance is not restrictive enough. And the only way to become more restrictive is to make sure that the long part of the yield curve rises.
I guess the question is, how much of that can they fully control, right? I mean, sort of finance 101 is, you know, the Fed controls the short end, not the long end. And as much as they've done QE and QT, you know, it seems like there's some evidence that suggests that's still largely market driven. So they may need it, but I guess the question is, how much can they really affect it?
Well, yes, absolutely. It's much harder for the Federal Reserve to affect long-term yields, because the way that long-term yields work is that they price according to market expectations on growth. And that's what we have seen in the past few weeks. As soon as the market sees signs of a recession, we have the 10 years dropping. Then it also prices on inflation expectations. And if inflation expectations have become somewhere anchored above 2% levels, then that's also negative for this part of the yield curve. But also, Michael, going back to the term premium, I think that's very important, because what happens now is that the 10-year U.S. Treasury yields around 4% is telling me that there is going to be a soft landing, because it's basically showing me that there is going to be growth around 2%, inflation around 2%. And that's the description of a soft landing. But what if the Federal Reserve starts to taper quantitative tightening and at the same time, let's say in June, begins to cut rates? Well, that and inflation is still not at 2%. At that point, basically, we can have a resurgence of bond vigilante, and they're going to say, well, I don't want to hold 10-year yields at 4% because there might be a risk of a rebound in inflation because of the behavior and the decisions of the Federal Reserve, and the term premium might rise. And that's why I think that the 10 years at 4% right now, the fair value should be more closer to 5%. But still, when you look at the offering that the 10 years has on a balanced portfolio, it makes sense if you want to hedge against a downturn.
What other dynamic could have the effect of a 5% type of fair value rate where the Fed wouldn't be the cause of it? I'm thinking in terms of, you know, currency movement. If the dollar were to have a spike, that's a disinflationary force. You know, that's a form of tightening, or broader volatility in risk assets. I mean, it seems like you could still get to a restrictive place, but you need the Fed to not be the primary source of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the Federal Reserve is scared of that prospect, because we had the Federal Reserve pivoting in December after basically 10-year yields hit 5% in November. And the Federal Reserve pivoted in December despite having five quarters of U.S. GDP above trend and inflation still being above 3%. Michael, I think that the Federal Reserve is political, But we cannot hide the fact that 2024 is all about the US election. And the Federal Reserve is composed by human beings that are going to vote in that elections. So when they look at the real rates slightly below 2%, they are panicking, believing that they might be too restrictive and the economy might suffer, let's say, just before the U.S. election in summer. And basically, it would compromise the outcome of the U.S. election or will influence it. So what is happening here, I think, that they are going along with this kind of preventing preemptive cuts and preemptive quantitative tightening tapering just because they are afraid that something might break close enough to the U.S. election.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Read my mind on that because I saw a headline that said that Biden predicts the Fed will cut rates this year. And it's like, all right, now they're just kind of outright saying it, right? Not even hiding it. But the political side of it, it's an interesting discussion. It's not clear to me if it's politically bad for them to, or good for them to, lower rates in advance of an election, just because if they lower rates, they're going to be accused by the Republicans of supporting the Democrats. If they don't lower rates, then Republicans will say, look at the Democrats, they're making the cost of money so high for you. So it seems like the Fed, either way, doesn't win politically.
Absolutely. And the Federal Reserve is trying to find a balancing act, really, in order to get to those U.S. elections. But also, like we said before, if the Federal Reserve cut rates and the market is not sure that inflation it is under control, then bond vigilantes can ask for a higher return premium and the 10 years can go rapidly towards 5%. And that's obviously a very bad situation for this for the Federal Reserve. So I really believe that what the Federal Reserve is going to do is tapering first, quantitative tightening. And the reason for that is that it makes sense because the runoff of T-bills accelerate since June. They're going to assess the tapering, how it's going to affect bond markets and look how inflation is going to behave. And then they are going to follow up with rate cuts. But to be clear, Michael, I don't think there is going to be a rate cut in September. It has to happen either after or before. And it's very likely that if the Federal Reserve believes that there is some sort of stress in markets, is going to cut before.
So this lends directly to a conversation around the name of the space, which I changed a few times, but talking about how Japan and monetary policy from the BOJ could impact U.S. markets. I put a post out there, which sounds a little conspiratorial, was meant to be a little bit dramatic, but basically said something along the lines of the Fed may want the Bank of Japan to cause some volatility through the reversal of the carry trade, to give them an excuse and for Japan to maybe be a scapegoat as far as them responding to volatility that could come from whatever the Bank of Japan does next and how that kind of metastasizes across the globe. So let's talk about the importance of the Bank of Japan when it comes to global leverage and what is, in your opinion, coming. It does seem like they're going to act and it's not clear what the secondary tertiary effects are going to be.
Well, it seems very much that the Bank of Japan is going to act because the modus operandi of the Bank of Japan is that it leaks stories to the media. And we had several stories from the Bank of Japan, from various medias in Japan, saying that the Bank of Japan is willing to exit yield curve control as soon as this month and hike rates. So I think that it is really coming. And what does that mean? Well, before considering what does that mean for U.S. treasuries, we have to consider that Japanese investors hold around 15% of all U.S. treasuries outside of Japan. So if they stop buying U.S. treasuries or even European sovereign bonds, that is going to be a blow for the U.S. treasuries, and that is going to show off as higher yields on both sides of the Atlantic. So to understand how Japanese investors buy U.S. treasuries, they normally have to hedge this position against the Japanese yen. And so they are going to buy, for example, 10-year U.S. treasuries, and then they are going to sell dollar-yen forward, 3 months forward. If you do that right now, you would secure a yield of minus 1.2%. And Japanese investors, they can get 0.7%, 75% on their 10 years JGB. So it doesn't make sense for them to buy 10-year U.S. treasuries. You can argue that they might want to buy 10-year U.S. treasuries unhedged. But even like that, if we have the Federal Reserve telling us that they are going to cut rates, and we have the Bank of Japan telling us that they are going to hike rates, is not convenient for Japanese investors to buy 10-year U.S. treasuries either. So, Michael, it all comes to what happens also to U.S. treasury auctions, because the U.S. treasury is selling an amount at every auction that is equal or above pandemic levels. So the last month, the U.S. Treasury has sold $42 billion 10-year notes. This month, actually tomorrow, the U.S. Treasury is selling $39 billion 10-year U.S. notes. And that's the amount that we have seen during the pandemic. If we don't have the Federal Reserve buying, we don't have a Japanese investor buying, the question is the demand coming from everybody else enough to absorb this kind of supply? And I think that we are going to be answered that question already tomorrow. And what I'm going to look at that 10-year U.S. Treasury auction is the indirect bidders. I want to see indirect bidders can be not only foreign investors, also other investors that are not buying directly from the U.S. Treasury. But it gives an idea of how much demand outside of traditional buyers there for U.S. Treasuries. And that can spark, that can basically be a volatility kind of, it can cause volatility in bond markets, especially on the back of the CPI print.
It's interesting you say that, the point about, you know, where the demand come from. And I was loud about this last year. Obviously, my timing was not ideal, but I did show data that shows that historically in the top 1% of stock market declines, there is this flight to safety that happens into treasuries, into duration. I've used that line before that, you know, to save bonds, you have to crash stocks, or at least to save treasuries, you have to crash stocks, because it creates the flight to quality, flight to safety sequence for a moment in time. Right? Treasuries tend to drop in yield during extreme tail events for equities in a concentrated way. Is there a possibility that may be sort of the way we get past this demand issue, that it could just be absorbed by scared money and risk on assets if Japan decides to no longer buy treasuries and the Fed is doing tapering? Or is the supply so overwhelming that's unlikely?
I think that it's likely that we are going to have that this kind of supply is going to be absorbed by markets. Let's bear in mind that in every U.S. Treasury auction, there are always primary dealers that are buying whatever is not bought by indirect and direct bidders. But said so, if we have some sort of volatility that is going to affect equity markets, it's very likely to see that rotation from basically stocks to bonds. But the big question is which bonds are going to be picked up. And that's why when I tell you, yes, 10-year yields might rise to 5%, but I would still like to have them in my portfolio. I would like to have 10-year U.S. Treasuries in my portfolio. Why, if you think that basically the 10-year yields is going to go to 5%? Well, because if I'm a buy to hold investors and I try to make some sort of risk-reward analysis on the 10-year U.S. Treasury, if I assume 1 year holding periods, if 10-year yields rise to 5% within this time frame, I'm going to lose around 3%. But if 10 years are going to drop by 100 basis points, so to 3%, I'm going to make around 13%. And that's going to be risk-free. So the 10 years right now, because there has been this huge rise in yields that has also increased the coupon of this issuance, offers a very good risk and reward ratio. This changes if you're going to look at 30-year U.S. treasuries, because if you do the same kind of risk and reward analysis, well, it's going to be much more directional on the pace of interest rate cuts or deflation or disinflation. So if within 1 year, 30-year U.S. treasuries yields rise by 100 basis points, you are going to lose around 20% of your investment. And if they drop by the same amount, you're going to make 15%. So it's a much riskier kind of trade. And that's why I see the front part of the yield curve up to 10 years to benefit from such of from a rotation, let's say, from risky assets to safe assets. But the long part of the yield curve is really in doubt, as it offers no pickup over the 10 years or very slight pickup at 20 basis points or so.
Just to reset the room for the remaining 20 minutes, everybody, please make sure you follow Altea Spinozzi here on X. If any of you want to come up and ask questions, click that bottom left MicroQuest button. And as always, this will be in podcast under Lead Lag Live. Do you get a sense that, and I understand you're in Denmark, I don't think in the States people really understand how significant a policy shift from the BOJ could be. But do you get a sense that people are talking about it as if it could be a big deal internationally? Because even if they do scrap yield curve control and do raise, you know, out of negative, that's just an initial move. I mean, I've made this point before. There's no central bank in the world that's more lagged when it comes to inflation, an inflationary response than the Bank of Japan. And that's a central bank that doesn't even know how to deal with it, given, you know, their own disinflation, deflation for decades.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the problem here is that I think that we are going to have two kind of phases when that happens. So the first phase that is going to maybe benefit the U.S. treasuries, because it's going to be bearish for Japanese bonds if the Bank of Japan starts to hike rates and exit yield curve control. So maybe within that time frame, it makes sense for investors to buy elsewhere. But then there is going to be a kind of consolidation phase where the Bank of Japan is going to start hiking, and that's going to definitely see some repatriation from U.S. government bonds and European government bonds back home. Michael, just out of interest, when you look at the convenience of Japanese investors to buy either U.S. treasuries or European sovereign bonds, they are better off buying European sovereign bonds, because they, vis-a-vis from U.S. treasuries, once edged against the yen, they basically provide a higher yield.
Help me out with a narrative disconnect that I keep harping on. So AI is all the rage. And I am skeptical because I keep making this point that if AI is the next, let's call it industrial revolution, you have to be bullish on bonds because technology is inherently disinflationary, maybe even deflationary, and AI is supposed to be this exponential force. And yet yields haven't really moved all that much on that narrative. It's still being driven by, you know, at least near-term inflation concerns and the Fed. Am I often thinking that there's a divergence in the story around the AI and what that should imply for bonds broadly?
I think, yeah, you are spot on. I think that the play you are talking about is going to materialize, but is going to be a very much like long-term play. Right now, the bond market is focused only on inflation. And the reason for that is that inflation is driving yields, is driving nominal yields across the world. So if inflation is not resolved, if inflation is not going to go to 2% that easily, it might mean that the neutral rate, long-term neutral rate, is going to be above 2.5%. And that's going to change the valuation for all tenors across the yield curve. I want to make an example on the 70s, when we had very high inflation, very high unemployment, and low growth. So basically, as we can basically identify it, as stagflation was intensifying, so basically the economy was weaker and weaker, but inflation was not going back or basically descending fast towards 2%, U.S. Treasury nominal yields continued to rise. And that sets an example that until inflation is not dead, the focus on bond market will continue to be inflation, even if the Federal Reserve is telling us that the focus should be on a soft landing. And that has been what been, and that is increasing volatility in bond markets, especially on the long part of the yield curve. And Michael, on that point, on the long part of the yield curve and short part of the yield curve kind of point of view, I want to make the example of the two-year U.S. Treasury, which I think that now offers a win solution for all kind of investors. Because you see, if I assume a holding period of 6 months, I need 2 year yields to go from 4.5% to 6.3% before starting to record a negative return. So basically the two, it's almost impossible to lose money within this part of the yield curve. The only way that it's possible to lose money in this part of the yield curve is if the Federal Reserve hikes another 6 times, which right now doesn't look probable, especially with China being in deflation and probably Europe joining deflation in the second part of the year.
Okay, so that's a good direction to go. The deflationary effect of China, I'd say more than Europe, but we can debate that. Has it been surprising at all that China hasn't taken out like a bazooka to try to counter the deflationary forces? Or is there maybe a realization that they can't do much because of how much debt they have in general?
I think what's happening in China is that policymakers just don't want to end up like Japan. And that's why they're basically letting the real estate bubble to burst and they are not actively helping the economy. The consequences it will have globally can be massive, and we will see one of the first consequences probably in Europe, where we see basically inflation to be fast returning to 2%, and people starting to talk about deflation in the second part of the year. Let's be clear that the ECB could have already cut rates, but it didn't so because I still concern that in terms of euro currency, a devaluation of the currency will bring again a rebound of inflation because everything is put in US dollars. But I think that the direction is going to be that one going forward.
Yeah, and actually I would think if somehow China decided to reverse their mindset on that and create a short-term inflationary boom, then commodities would run, and that then really would force the Fed's hand to resume the rate hike cycle just because of the cost push inflationary side of the equation.
Absolutely. But so far, you know, like 2023 has been full of bets around China, and we didn't see any of those materializing. So it's a very kind of unsafe bet right now. I think that it's better to think as of to take out China in the equation and basically focus on domestic kind of trends. And also, Michael, if you think about the U.S. election, that can be inflationary as well, right? Because both candidates are going to increase fiscal spending. And in the case of Trump, we might get even a geopolitical rise in tensions, and that's going to be bad, it's going to basically increase prices of goods. So that can be like our deflationary risk looking ahead, the U.S. election rather than China basically rebounding or the Bank of China to help the economy.
You mentioned the Eurozone and Germany in particular, and going back to 2011, Germany was the poster child for arguing for austerity, right, rather than trying to save the sovereign debt crisis back then. And now, as I have seen, they're in a recession, even though the markets have actually done pretty well. Any thoughts on opportunities when it comes to the Bunds relative to treasuries? They too, from what I've seen, tend to act in a risk-off way when you have high volatility, meaning there's that flight-to-safety dynamic that you see in the U.S. You also see it in Germany. I don't think it's a uniform response, but what are your thoughts on Germany?
Well, Germany, the problem with Bunds in general is that there is a massive scarcity of collateral in Europe. And that's why normally when we have some dovish remarks, it can be even from the Federal Reserve, the Bunds are going to be more sensitive to such remarks than other European sovereigns out there. I think that, honestly, we have seen the government, politicians in Germany arguing for more fiscal spending, but so far it has not been that great in order to affect the availability of Bunds in the market. So I honestly think that the Bunds is going to be, you know, like a better safe haven, especially like when we look at where the European macroeconomic backdrop stands versus the U.S. than U.S. treasuries. But said that, Michael, everything is connected, and the correlation between U.S. treasuries and bonds is positive. So it's going to be very unlikely if we see a rebound of the long part, let's say 10-year U.S. treasury yields, that bond yields will not follow. But, you know, like in terms of resilience and volatility, they are going to be definitely a better investment.
So on that point about the correlation's positive, is there historical evidence that the correlation of credit spread movements in the Eurozone is there when it comes to U.S. Corporate credit? So as I understand it, the Eurozone credit spreads have been widening while ours in the U.S. have been, you know, obviously tightening and at these kind of cycle lows when you look at junk. Is there a correlation there, and is there maybe even a lag? Because maybe the Eurozone, if that's the dynamic, is sort of a leading indicator of what comes next for corporate credit in the U.S.
Yeah, well, the thing is that in terms of European corporate bond spreads, they haven't really been widening. They have been stabilizing somewhat higher while basically U.S. corporate bond spreads continued to tighten. And the reason for that can be explained very much from the macroeconomic backdrop that we see in Europe. We are basically in a recession, and the economy is expected to improve, but at a much slower pace than what was forecasted earlier. So we are going to be stuck in this kind of stagflation mode, which is negative for corporate bonds, and that's why investors are demanding a higher spread than the U.S. But you are completely right. When there is a correlation between corporate bond markets in the U.S. and in Europe, and when we have some problems in the U.S., that is going to spread very fast, even in Europe. And we had that kind of confirmation during the SVB crisis the kind of concerns were surrounding only U.S. banks, and that spread anyway to the European space.
I'll tell you, for those who want to track more of your thoughts, more of your work, I understand with Saxo Bank, you're putting a lot of content out probably for institutional clients of yours, but where can people track some of your thoughts?
I'm posting a lot on Twitter. A lot of time I also post articles. The majority of my analyses are available on the Saxo website. So definitely you can follow me and you can look at the publication there. I normally talk about European rates, U.S. Treasury rates, and also UK rates. So if any interest, you can definitely look me up.
Everybody, please make sure you give Althea here a follow. I have another space coming up, so stay tuned for that. And for those that are not going to join the next one, I feel sorry for you. So anyway, thank you, Althea. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael, for inviting me, and good luck for the next speaker.
Cheers, everybody.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at LeadLag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the LeadLag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.